Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and in the studio with me as a co-host this week is Liz Walsh, Elizabeth Walsh, Professor of Biological Sciences at UT El Paso. And our guest today is going to be talking about the big topic, and it's pollination. And who does the pollination? Well, they're pollinators. And what's the gentleman's name? He's Professor Nigel Rain, the University of Guelph up there in Ontario, Canada. And we're going to learn a lot. So, Nigel, welcome to Science Studio.
Hello. Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's going to be fun, I think. I hope. But before we get on to pollinators, pollination, and all that good stuff, let's talk a little bit about Nigel. How did you become, first of all, a scientist? And how on earth do you get into being an avid fan of pollinators?
Well, it's been an interesting journey. I mean, I've always been interested in natural history from since I was a child, I guess, and that has never really left me. And I was lucky enough to do a biological sciences degree and do all the zoology courses I could possibly do and lots of ecology. And I started to think more about pollination and pollinators because of the people around me who were working on those questions. And I had sort of really great role models during my undergraduate degree and ended up doing some field work with them on the pollination ecology of acacia trees in East Africa. And that led on to my PhD, so I spent an awful lot of time watching pollinators on flowers and looking at how different tree species shared pollinators and but still managed to effectively reproduce.
You went through 20 years of your life in about
yep.
a minute. I want to know
yeah.
back when you were a kid, when you yeah. were a little boy or a younger boy in high school or grammar school for you, I guess, what was it that brought you into the natural history, as you put it?
Well, I it's hard to sort of pinpoint. I guess I've always been interested in watching animals and how they interact with their environment.
So you're not a city boy then, for example? You didn't grow up in the middle of London?
I didn't grow up in the middle of London. I grew up in a kind of a small town in Warwickshire in the centre of England. So, yeah, we would spend quite a bit of time outside, riding your bike around the countryside, looking at things. We had fields behind the house, and I would go and explore those and look at insects and what other animals we could find, looking at flowers and plants. And clearly, what visits flowers? Well, bees and other pollinators visit them. So, well, you know, you're lucky to just kind of experience nature in that way. And I think the longer you look at nature, the longer you look at any kind of aspect of it, the more interesting interactions you'll find. You'll find curious behaviors that animals perform, and even relatively simple animals like insects clearly do a lot of interesting behaviors, whether that's kind of flying around and visiting flowers, or whether that's interacting with other individuals or other species, whether they have predatory behaviors, and all of these things are you can lose yourself in watching them.
Okay, so Liz, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree. Just yesterday when I was going to leave for work, I was looking at the sunflower patch that we have growing outside by our driveway, and the bees were just incredible. They were zooming from one flower to another, going to interact with another bee, and I must have spent like 10 minutes sitting there just watching these bees and trying to figure out what they were doing with all of this activity, because they were intensely active at that time of the day, gathering pollen and communicating with each other. It was really fascinating.
Absolutely. Any time I go past, my family will attest to this, when we go out on a walk, or I'm usually lagging behind looking at things on flowers until they get fed up and just walk off, and I have to catch them up. So, I mean, they have the bug as well. Yesterday morning, we had some monarch butterfly chrysalises that we'd collected earlier in the season, and they hatched out. So my kids and I were releasing them yesterday morning. It was a little bit cold here, so they sat very quietly for a while. They were just kind of warming up their flight muscles, and eventually they did take off and start their migratory route down to Mexico. And it's hard to tear yourself away from that when they're at the start of an epic migration. So That's quite a special moment to share with them.
I remember maybe 10 years ago, I did a sabbatical in Mexico, and one of the great experiences of my life was taking our children to see the monarch butterflies down there in a place called Angangueo, but it's down in the middle of Mexico. Absolutely amazing. So
I've seen photographs. I've never made it to the winter roost, but I hope to do so at some point. They look wonderful.
Yeah, me too. That's on my list to do as well. Just hoping that the political situation down there calms down and that the deforestation stops so that we can continue to have roosting areas for these fabulous butterflies.
Okay, so that's enough reminiscing and looking into the future for good trips. Let's talk. Nigel, tell us, what is a pollinator? I mean, it's not just bees. There's a whole range of these things. I remember talking to you a little earlier. Flies. I mean, they do have some redeeming feature to them. Tell us a little bit about what is happening during pollination and where is most of the issues that we're having to deal with today?
Okay, so there's a huge diversity of pollinators, as you very rightly point out. Bees are something that immediately springs to everyone's mind because they rely on flowers to provide them with all of their food, the nectar and pollen, because essentially they are vegetarian wasps. They diverged a long time ago, but that's what they've specialized in as their kind of food source. So they regularly visit flowers and they move pollen from the male parts of one flower to the female parts of another flower, and that is kind of a byproduct of their foraging, the fact that they're looking for food. They carry some of that pollen, the stuff that they've actually not collected to feed to their offspring, is the pollination that benefits the plants in this sort of co-evolutionary situation. But there are many other types of pollinators, flies, particularly flower flies or hoverflies, some people call them. They can be important. They can move over large areas and visit flowers a lot. You can have moths and butterflies. Wasps can perform pollination. Beetles, bats, hummingbirds, rodents, even ants under some circumstances. Otherwise, although they're relatively poor pollinators because they don't fly long distances, they don't fly for much of their life cycle, and generally the ones that are flying, the sexuals, are not visiting flowers. So anything that lands on a flower that can get dusted with pollen and can transfer that pollen to another flower or another part of the same flower or another flower individually to generate seed set and fruit set for those plants.
So when I sneeze because I've got an allergy and pollen at my nose, am I actually a pollinator if I'm close enough to some other?
Potentially, if you're close enough to another conspecific, another plant of the same species, and you blew that pollen onto that plant, yes, that could count.
Good.
Clearly, there are a whole bunch of other plants that don't rely on pollinators that are wind pollinated or. And many of those are very important as well. So clearly we have a lot of grass species, for example, and many cereal species or cereals that we rely on as crops.
Well, since we're talking about bees, and I know up there in Guelph at the university, you've got a lot of people thinking and studying the whole business of bees. One reads in the newspapers, one hears sort of conversations that there's a bee issue, there's a problem. There's not enough of them, or et cetera, et cetera. But then, as you pointed out, there are pollinating bees and there are different types of bees. What's the big issue with bees these days?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. There are global reports of declines in insects, and that includes pollinators. Many wild bee species and other wild pollinator species are less abundant than they used to be. They occupy a broad range than they used to. Certainly, from the data that we have from the long-term long-term studies that people have published, if that continues, and in some crops already, there is evidence that there are insufficient pollinators to do the work we need them to do in crops, and that is the movement of the pollen to allow the crops to fully set seed and to produce high quality and high yield crops. That isn't all crops, that's only the insect-dependent ones, but that makes up a substantial proportion of our fruits and vegetable and nut crops, important commodities like coffee and chocolate, and even feeds, it goes into livestock feed. So a lot of the food that we feed to our livestock animals is also pollinator-dependent. So we have a sort of global decline, and we need to understand the reasons behind that decline and to ameliorate and hopefully reverse those declines so that we can continue to rely on the diversity of pollinators to support the variety of agricultural and wild pollination systems that are really important to us as humans and also to the planet as a whole in terms of the ecosystem.
Well, and one of the contributors to the decline are the persistent use of pesticides across the globe.
Sure, that's definitely one of the issues that we've been working on. There are multiple different stress factors that we know are causing problems for pollinators. Loss and reduction of sort of connectivity of habitat is a really key point. So where they nest, where they feed, where there are flowers, that goes hand in hand with our increased sort of human footprint, increased urbanization, increased agricultural intensification, which speaks to your point about more and persistent use of pesticides on a big scale in agriculture. We know that climate change is a big factor. That really seems to be disrupting the normal timing of pollinator activity and flowering patterns. And the synchrony between those two things is really important for pollinator communities and for them to be able to do that. We know that pathogens and parasites are really important. Lots of work on managed honeybees has shown that there are a diverse range of pathogens and parasites that are associated with varroa mites in honeybees. And varroa mites are very good at transmitting those between honeybees. But more recently, a whole swath of those parasites that we thought were, or pathogens that we thought were restricted to honeybees, seem to be found much more broadly in wild pollinators. And we know that in invasive species, be that invasive diseases, pollinators or plants, can really also affect these systems. And it's a combination of these different factors that seems to be driving pollinator declines. And understanding the importance of each of those and trying to mitigate the stress caused by each of those is important in the whole.
Well, sounds like there's a pretty grim array of problems to be discussed and to look at. And it all comes down, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's just too many people. We need food. We need, therefore, pesticides, fungicides and the like. But when we do it to protect one crop, presumably, it has a threat to another crop. In the cases you're talking about, honeybees or pollinating bees. What is the sort of general consensus as to an approach that says we can have everything at the same time, have the cake and eat it?
Well, as you say, that's a really complex issue. There are increasing numbers of humans on the planet, and that we don't see that changing anytime soon. We're looking to feed 9 billion people by the middle of this century. We need to think very carefully about how we're producing food, where we're producing it, what types of food we're producing it, being cognizant that lots of the crops we're growing are not just food crops. They also feed into energy debates, sustainable energy production, but being clear about where we are growing food, how we're protecting that with different ways to control pests. As you say, if we're doing big scale monocultures, then pest threats are very real, and chemical pesticides are one way of controlling those commercially and sustainably damaging pests. But we also need to think about diversifying our landscapes such that we do have the space, the habitat, to support many beneficial insects, including pollinators. Clearly, things like insecticides, we know that they're designed to kill insect pests, but a lot of the mechanisms by which insecticides kill pest insects also have a potential for damaging effects on beneficial insects, like some predatory species that might actually provide biocontrol in crops, and also clearly pollinating insects that might be visiting those crops. So we have to find a way that we can use those pesticides where we need to use them, where the economic thresholds or the pest damage threshold has been breached, but applying them in such a way that there aren't unintended non-target impacts on these beneficial pollinators. So that can be taken as part of a wider suite of sort of integrated pest management, thinking about greater rotation of crops to reduce the buildup of these damaging pests, to think about how we scout our crops and how we apply the pesticides. We've been working a lot on a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, and they have sort of changed the game over the last 20 to 25 years, where they've been used extensively as seed treatments in many of the agriculturally important crops, and they're applied before the seed goes into the ground. So you've made a decision to treat or not treat the crop before you've even seen what the pest pressure is for a particular season. So you have to be really sure that you know there's going to be a pest pressure before you should consider using those. And we've kind of moved away from that to a to a more sort of prophylactic use of many of these compounds in wide-scale agriculture. And recently that has started, there's started to be backpedaling on that in Europe. There's been substantial restrictions on the use of those compounds as seed treatments, and Canada is discussing that as well to a lesser extent and over a longer time period than the European Union has. So there's obviously sort of policy debates about how we sort of allow these control products to be used, but still but minimize the potential impacts they might have for beneficial insects like pollinators.
Well, that brings up the whole issue of the responsibility of people like yourself and ourselves, scientists in general, and getting their knowledge out to policymakers. So we'll discuss that, but we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Elizabeth Walsh, Nigel Rain up there in Guelph, Canada, and we'll be back in one moment.